Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain's you to become pollution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! A minute past the hour, and we find ourselves at the middle of the final full week of March 2015. This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com. It's our home, and that, of course, is where you go if you want to jump into the chat room, where we have a rollicking conversation most every evening. News Ninja Carol Baker and Gerald having popped in so far, and more folks hopefully on the way. Hey, look, there's Jug of Punch. We don't stand on precedent around here. It's not like we're going to lock you out of the chat room if you're not here right at the beginning of the program. But yeah, you go to headonradionetwork.com if that's where you'd like to. If you want to join in the rollicking good times, the full time multimedia experience that is the chat room during a live program. Also, of course, you go to headonradionetwork.com if you want to help us keep all of this on the air, as you all have been doing for 10 years now. And, of course, the PayPal interface is under the tab Contribute, and there's a couple of pushy little things, like, you know, your Aunt Matilda's corset girth. You don't have to fill that in there. It's just about getting to the next screen. And we try to raise $150 every evening. We are out a little bit in front, and are, for the first time in a very long time, quite near to being able to be fully paid up at the end of the month and not be playing catch-up, which is awfully, awfully nice. So we will hopefully find 3 at 50, 6 at 25, 10 at 15, 15 at 10, 30 at 5, whatever it takes to make the evening's fundraising goal. Of course, if you prefer to participate by the U.S. Postal Service method, you are welcome to send checks and money orders that are not made out to Bob Kincaid, but are made out instead to The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, W-V 25801. And, hey, there is Barbie. Barbie's in the house. Barbie's in the room. Hey, Barbie. So, more and more folks wandering by. And I have a feeling we'll have a good group this evening. And I certainly hope we have a good group this evening. Oh, that was a nice flurry. Good evening, Jeremy in Vermont. Good evening, Devin, popping in. Good evening, John. Yeah, see how this happens? Yeah, we're liberal. We're progressive. We wander in at our own pace. Thank you very kindly, Jeremy. Loud and clear on TuneIn, Jeremy notes. And that's important because, well, you know that I don't do just a heck of a lot of planned, scheduled interviews here. I generally prefer the conversations that we have amongst ourselves. But every now and then, an opportunity comes along to do an interview, a conversation, if you will, that grabs my attention and that I think, I hope, will also be entertaining, informative, and maybe even a little bit mind-blowing to the whole Horn Family Commune congregation. This evening is just such an evening. It is not very often that one gets an opportunity to interface with living history, with titans of their art, but this is one of those evenings. Just by way of introduction, I've talked from time to time about that little place in northwest Alabama where I grew up. It is generally referred to as the Shoals. It is named for a set of rapids that once existed on the Tennessee River there. The Tennessee River, once upon a time by the original inhabitants of the area, was referred to as the river that sings. And that makes good sense because, indeed, that river did sing insofar as those rapids, the Mussel Shoals, mussels, you know, freshwater shellfish, existed in profuse abundance through that area. And for it's not entirely clear whether the Mussel Shoals were named, you know, shoals are small, you know, shallow water, usually a lot of rocks, very dangerous. It's not entirely clear whether the shoals were named for the mussels, the freshwater shellfish that existed there and were eaten lots and lots by the native population, or whether they were named for the fact that when one was taking a boat down the river, one had to mussel one's way through the shoals. It's now spelled M-U-S-C-L-E. Either way, those shoals disappeared in large part with the arrival of the dam system that later became the Tennessee Valley Authority through North Alabama and into Tennessee as well. And that area is, and it's not just to me, that area is special. Nobody can really put a finger on why, but it is. It is the area that gave rise to the woman who went on to become known as America's First Lady of Courage, Helen Keller, who overcame obstacles that most of us can't even imagine to become a noted socialist thinker and an advocate for the differently abled in society. It also gave birth to a man by the name of William Christopher Handy, known as the father of the blues. I sure hope Bill, Mr. Stress, is listening right now, because the conversation that I hope is coming up here in a few minutes, I mean, we scheduled it and everything, but, you know, sometimes things go sideways. I hope it doesn't. Cross your fingers, cross your toes, knock wood. Yeah, I just hit myself in the head. Because Bill is going to just go gaga with the conversation we're about to have, I think. William Christopher Handy, the father of the blues, came up out of Florence, Alabama. Helen Keller came out of Tuscumbia, Alabama. The Shoals area is comprised of four towns: Florence, Sheffield, Mussel Shoals, and Tuscumbia. Mussel Shoals was going to be the beating heart of Henry Ford's automotive empire until the federal government refused to sell him Wilson Dam. The main drag there in Mussel Shoals is named Avalon Avenue, and anybody who's ever been to Detroit knows what that means. But it's a very special place. Writers, artists, designers, journalists, Pulitzer Prize winners have all come up out of that little corner of northwest Alabama. And it's sort of, for those of you who are familiar with the play, it's kind of Brigadoonish, because it's like you only get there if you're supposed to. My parents got there because Reynolds Metals Company wanted to make silicon metal there, and a 37-year-old hillbilly coal miner furnace operator decided to pull up stakes and go there, as many people did from all over the country. And it became, all told, there was maybe 40,000 people there. But at the time that I was born and growing up, it was 40,000 people that just made for this perfect mix, or near-perfect mix, this stunning mix of attitudes and desires and traditional values, cultures coming in from outside. And it was, there's no interstate that goes through the shoals. There was only one four-lane highway that came in there, and it came in from the east, from Huntsville. The nearest interstate highway was 40 miles to the east in Athens. The interstate system was young back then, of course. And so it's almost like culturally it developed. You know, it wasn't Tennessee and it wasn't Mississippi, and it wasn't the Alabama of the Deep South, like Montgomery. And rolling through it all, that magnificent river. Big bluffs on the south side and bottom land that went all the way down to the river's edge on the north side. And it gave rise to music. Sam Phillips, who discovered Elvis, was from the Shoals, as you know, along with W.C. Handy and Helen Keller. He founded his recording operation in Memphis, Tennessee, and gave the world Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash, Carl Perkins, and changed the face of American music forever. That was the first wave. The conversation we'll be having in a couple of minutes is, I suppose you could say, the second wave. We're talking about R&B, country, rock and roll, soul. Just to give you an idea of what we're dealing with, let's see. I'll bet you. Let's see. Well, it all kind of starts with this song.
I've got to see you somehow, not tomorrow, right now. I know it's late, whoa, I can't wait, so come on and steal away, please steal away.
That's Jimmy Hughes and Steal Away, produced by legendary music producer and founder of Fame Recording Studios, Rick Hall. He would go on, Mr. Hall would, to give the world, let's see, how about When a Man Loves a Woman by Percy Sledge? How about Mustang Sally by Wilson Pickett? How about Arthur Alexander's You Better Move On, that was later covered by the Stones, and changed the career of Aretha Franklin forever when she came to Muscle Shoals and recorded I Never Loved a Man the Way I Love You. Well, Rick Hall has a memoir out now, brand new, coming out the beginning of next month. The Man from Muscle Shoals, Rick Hall, My Journey from Shame to Fame. And well, I've had the privilege of reading an advance copy, and it is absolutely riveting. If you are a lover of music, you're going to be absolutely blown away by this book. Having grown up in the Shoals, I guess I took a lot of this for granted in some ways, in as much as the first person who ever taught me to run a mixer was the son of a sax player for the Muscle Shoals Horns. I played peewee baseball with Roger Hawkins's little boy. Went to school with David Hood, magnificent bass player's son. And they all of these musicians got their start with Rick Hall. And it is my pleasure and my honor to welcome Rick Hall to this conversation this evening. Mr. Hall, thank you very much for taking time to join us.
Oh, Bobby, thank you, sir. I appreciate you. I appreciate you saying all the good things about me. And Half of them are true.
No, they're all true.
They're all very true.
And
Bob, you're a good man, and I love you for having me on the air with you.
Well, it is, like I said, it's an absolute joy for me. You are a giant of the industry. Most people probably have their radios on at any given time anywhere in the world, and there's something that Rick Hall's hands have touched that are in turn lifting their spirits or speaking to the moment that they're in. Let's begin I want folks to understand why it is that I wax so rhapsodic about the Shoals.
Yes.
What is it about that little corner of the world?
Well, I'll tell you, it's called hunger. We believe that that in order to have a hit record, you have to be the best in the world. You can't just be the best in Colbert County or Muscle Shoals, Alabama. You have to be the best in the world. And to be the best in the world, you've got to spend a lot of time and a lot of energy. And, of course, we were doing music a little different from everybody else from Nashville and New York City and Los Angeles, California. So we were doing a little funky, a little lowbrow kind of music. From Cotton Patches and from the Mississippi Delta. And so I think the Muscle Show sound has to do with the energy that we've put into our records and how bad we wanted it. I mean, we really wanted it. We wanted to be somebody special. We didn't want to just cut hit records. We wanted to be our name to be on the map, and we wanted to, I want to show the world that I could do it. I mean, you know, just because I'm from Alabama and in the land where George Wallace hanging out and all that stuff, well, I was different. We were colorblind, and we wanted to do our own music, and we wanted to do our own thing. So we did it without any fanfare or any. We didn't have arrangers. We didn't have, nobody could read music. We just played from our heart and soul. And that's what the Muscle Show sound is. It's like you dug it out the ground or the middle of the Tennessee River. And that's where we were coming from. And that's what we were doing. We were trying to cut the best record that ever been.
The fact of the matter is, the blues is born of pain, and R&B comes up out of the blues tradition. And there was a lot of pain and a lot of suffering and way past just hard work that went into the creation of Fame Recording Studio. Tell people a little bit, if you don't mind, about your upbringing, please.
Well, Bob, I grew up as a and people always ask me, and it's a great question, why the shame? You know, where does the shame come from? I know about the fame, but where does shame come from? Well, the shame came from the fact that we were very, very poor, didn't have adequate clothes to wear to school. My mom left me when I was 4 or 5 years old, and my dad raised me. So my mom went to work in a red light district. And of course, that was very shameful to me, and I was always ashamed of that. We never had decent houses to live in. We lived in a slab hut. My father was a sawmiller. We had no bathrooms, no windows, no porches, a dirt floor, and straw beds that we slept on that we pulled straw out of the fields where we worked, and picked and hoed cotton.
How old were you when TVA finally brought electricity to you?
I was probably 16, somewhere in that area. And they came in and put all the dams on the Tennessee River. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt was my dad's saving grace. He felt like this, he was going to Franklin Delano Roosevelt when he died, you know.
And may well have.
He might have. He may be there today. But it was tough times, and we had a hard, very hard time. And that's what drove me to the music business, because me, like most black people, and I'm not black, but I wouldn't be ashamed to be black, because I've always loved black people and loved black music, and so we fit right in my band, and we always played the Muddy Waters, and we played the Clarence Frogman Henry and Gary U.S. Bonds and all that kind of stuff when I was growing up, and we played that kind of music, and so we lived it. So it was not hard for us to do what we loved, and we did love it. But in a small town like Muscle Shoals, Alabama, where you've got 8,000 people, and that's what we had at the time, you better be the best, because you're not going to be around long if you're not.
Well, you were too young to have you were a child during the Second World War, but you did get called up to military service. And one of the things I found fascinating in reading your memoir is that you were a conscientious objector.
Yes, sir. I was a conscientious objector because my father had taught me the Bible, and we were Bible Belt people. We were conservative people. My dad was a church goer and believed in gospel music, and he wouldn't work. He wouldn't hit a lick on Sunday, and he wouldn't take a job if he had to work on Sunday. So we were Southern people, and we had all that bringing up in the church and that kind of thing, and so we all had when I went into the Army, I was drafted into the Army during the Korean War. And so I was, they asked me, he said, do you believe in killing people? And I said, no, I don't. They said, do you believe in it enough to be a conscientious objector? And I said, yes, I do. So I was a conscientious objector. I can't speak for spluttering. And so we had to carry mops and brooms on our shoulder when everybody else was carrying an M1 rifle. Two basic training, of course. But that did
get you into it carried you along the way as far as the arc of your musical career was concerned, because beyond being a producer, you're a musician in your own right, and you played in an Army band?
Played in an Army band and played in San Antonio, Texas. I was in the medical corps, and obviously I was, the sergeant told me, I said, look, I don't have a gun or a weapon or anything, and what if I get killed up there? He said, well, all you won't need a weapon on the front lines, because you won't have time to use one anyhow. All you'll be doing is dragging the sick and wounded back from the front line to the medical aid station, and so you won't have time to be shooting at people. which was a little bit tiring to me. I thought, well, you know, I've got a tough gig here, you know. But Bob, are you any relation to Bradley Kincaid?
No, sir, I'm not. All of my people came out of West Virginia, and my dad moved down to the Shoals area to work for Reynolds Metals Company in 1960 on the silicon furnace there.
Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Well, my dad went to work at Reynolds Metals Company, and he worked in the pot room.
I grew up hearing plenty about the pot room. Of course, my dad worked on the reduction side, and I'd know it had been a tough day when he'd walk in the door and say, we broke off a stub, which meant that one of them great big gigantic carbon electrodes had snapped off right in the middle of the pile down there in the furnace, and they'd have to stop everything and dig it out. Hard work, but it was treasured work, because my dad would always, every now and then he'd look at me and say, Goody, I get to go to work today. Because he absolutely loved, he loved that plant.
My dad did the same thing. He worked there, and he was so proud of that job. He thought, well, this is incredible. I've got a good job and getting good pay, so, like I say, he was fortunate to be in the Tennessee Valley where there was quite a bit of work, and he helped clear the ground that the Wilson Down is sitting on today, which is the backwaters for the area.
And the fact of the matter is that economic growth that happened there in Northwest Alabama kind of set the stage, didn't it, for the growth, if you will, that allowed a blossoming of music.
No doubt about it. We of course we all knew how to work, and of course a lot of people were cotton pickers that I worked with, Arthur Alexander's, Percy Sledge, and people like that. They picked cotton for a living. And when Wilson Pickett came down here, I recall I was going to the studio from the airport, and Wilson Pickett said to me, he said, "Rick, what, are those people that picking cotton out there?" And I said, "Yes, sir, they're picking cotton. They're still picking cotton, Wilson." But I said, "Do you know some of them have got cotton pickers, and they will eventually, you know, stop all that cotton picking." But he was concerned about he thought maybe we were going to strap a cotton sack on his back, and he was going to start picking cotton too. But
he wasn't entirely comfortable, and some of the folk got your way to work. You were instrumental in transforming the career of Aretha Franklin, but that didn't come easy either, did it?
Come tough. It was very tough. And Bob, it was terrible. I mean, it was Jerry Wexler, of course, he was the man I adored and thought was the greatest guy in the world because he owned Atlantic Records, and he gave me a lot of chances. I had Wilson Pickett with him, and I had old Clarence Carter, who had went on to have the first number one record that Atlantic ever had, which was called Patches.
Yep.
And, of course, Otis Redding was there, and he was a good friend of mine, and I produced a couple of sides on him. Dwayne Allman was on the Atlantic record label. And so I was no stranger to, and Wilson Pickett was there. But I was no stranger to Atlantic Records and wanted to be a part of that organization and wanted to have hit records with them. So I was all about catering to Wexler and trying to be his fair-haired boy, you know.
But you note that it didn't come easy. Let's talk for a minute, just backing up a hair. What was it that led you personally into the recording side of the business? What was happening in the Shoals that made that possible for you?
Well, it wasn't easy, but I was a songwriter, Bob, and I'm a good songwriter. I had a lot of hits. I had hits on George Jones. I had hits on Roy Orbison. I had hits on Brenda Lee, and so I was locked in to Nashville because, you know, that Nashville is only like 120 or 30 miles from here, and so it was a hop and a jump up there. You jump in your car and you go up there and play songs to people, Owen Bradley or Chet Atkins, and the heads of the labels, and so I had made a considerable amount of money as a songwriter, and of course I was playing in a band. Everybody had a band. We all had bands, you know, from this area, because that was the livelihood. That was our livelihood. We played bands on weekends and dances and things like that. And of course, we played at the University of Alabama, Ole Miss, Auburn, and all of the colleges. And we played fraternity parties there. And then we played at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. So we were all musicians and we were all songwriters, and so that kicked me into high gear, and I said, well, you know what, I'm going to take a little of my money that I made, and I'm going to build a recording studio, and I'm going to start producing hit records. And
now,
everybody said, well, are you crazy? And I said, well, I may be, but I'm going to do it. I'm going to give it a shot.
Well, some.
So I was one of those guys who was full of pee and vinegar, you know.
Well, and the fact of the matter is, you know, you founded Fame Recording Studios, and Fame is just, well, I mean, that's the word. I mean, but the fact of the matter is, it stands for Florence, Alabama Music Enterprises. Did y'all mean for that to spell Fame, or did that just work out that way?
Well, it worked out that way because we didn't know. We called it Florence, Alabama Music Enterprises, and we wrote it down on a piece of paper and looked at it and said, you know what? If you take the first letter of each one of those words, Florence, Alabama Music Enterprises, and it spells Fame, and we said, you know, that's a better name than what we had. So we named it Fame, F-A-M-E, and so we've been telling times to lawyers and people who claim the word Fame and the movies and all that stuff, and so Hollywood was on our backs, but we had to fight them off. And we had to have a few lawsuits and that kind of thing, but we won out, and we had the original.
Well, let me, I mean, everybody under the sun seems like eventually came to record with you, but in the beginning, what you were producing was very much local and organic, was it not? I mean, Percy Sledge. Arthur Alexander, those were fellows from the Shoals too.
Yes, they were, and I couldn't get a toehold. I was having a hard time. Well, I did Arthur Alexander, and I played him all over the country, and went to Nashville and played him to all the disc jockeys up there and all the radio stations, and they said, well, he's too white for a black audience, and he's too black for a white audience. And so they all passed on it. Finally, I went to a fellow by the name of Noel Ball, who was a big disc jockey in Nashville, at a pop radio station called WMAK in Nashville. And he said, Rick, I like this tune. I like it a lot. I said, let me bring my assistant in here and let her hear it. And so he called her in, his assistant, and said, I think this is a hit. What do you think? Listen to it. Played it to her, and they said, well, would you mind me sending this to Hollywood, California? Because the Dot Record president is in Hollywood, California now. He just took over a Dot and moved him to California. He was from Tennessee. And so I said, no, be my guest. So he sent it to them, and Randy Wood, who was the president of the company, called Noel back and said, I want this record. I want us to sign Rick up as producer of this record and work out a deal with him, and we'll put it on the Dot Record label. Well, it was the only black act they had. They had Pat Boone and a lot of other people, you know, but they didn't have a black act. And so it turned out to be, because I had a few friends, and Joe Rumore and Duke Rumore and people in Birmingham and people in Montgomery, WLWI, and John Richburg in Nashville. He was an old friend of mine, and he was a huge black disc jockey, but he wasn't black. He was Jewish, but he sounded black. He said, oh, look out now. You know?
it sounds like Wolfman Jack before Wolfman Jack was Wolfman Jack.
It sounded like Wolfman Jack before Wolfman Jack came along. But he played all of my stuff for me, and of course other stations picked up on it because he was the first to play it, and he was a big guy, you know. So everybody felt like, you know, if it's good enough for John Hart, it's good enough for us, you know. So back then, you know, stations didn't have the problems of playing records that they do now. They just picked and choose what they wanted to play, and whatever they liked, they'd play it, and if the audience reacted, their phones lit up, they were all about it, you know. But now you got to go through all kinds of channels.
Well, and that was going to be one of my questions, Rick. The difference between then and now, because I came up in Shoals Radio. I started at WBTG and worked for WLAY and WQLT.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
Oh yeah. I was a pimply-faced 15-year-old disc jockey reading the news and spinning the chuck wagon gang over at WBTG. That was a different kind of radio. I mean, I don't even know if there's a 15-year-old kid out there who knows what it means to say cue up a record anymore.
No, I don't think there is. If there is, I don't know them. But WLAY is still, well, you know, it was one of the oldest stations and second oldest station, I understand, in the state of Alabama.
Yes, yes.
But, Sam Phillips worked there. The people that own, the Andersons that own Anderson Bookland and bookstores and all that stuff here.
Books a Million, yeah.
Now, who are in charge of, all of the Walmart stuff. They were disc jockeys there. Everybody, I met my wife there. Yeah, so at WLAY. And so, well, what brought you, took you up to where you are? Now I'm starting to interview you now.
Well, but you know what, Rick? That's just fine, because we call what we do here conversation radio instead of talk radio, and it may work out that way.
I think it's good. Like I said, my mom
and dad left here. He'd been a furnace operator, and he went down there. And all my life, while everybody else was on their summer vacations, they'd come back to school the next year and say, well, we went down to Gulf Shores. Where'd you go? I said, well, we went back to West Virginia, because they'd come back here from my grandmother's, my grandfather, coal mining folks. In a way, my dad had a little bit of a similar thing that what you're talking about with your mom and your dad. He got left by a woman who took to a different trade, shall we say, and left him with three youngins. So it just became a little intolerable around here, and he moved south to the Shoals. But I grew up always hearing about, and so this is kind of roots, and moved up to West Virginia and been involved in the human rights struggle up here for about 15 years now, relating to the coal industry and whatnot. But the fact of the matter is, if you're born down there, you know, that dirt's in your blood. And so, you know, the great talents that came up out of there. I think about Jack Voorhees, who was an early.
Jack was a dear friend of mine, and he was a great jock, you know. And he was the funniest man you ever heard, you know, on radio.
Well, he's the first man I ever heard doing character voices, on the radio there in my bedroom, little AM radio dialed to AM 1590.
He was that guy, you know.
Come on down to Fredrickson's. Yeah,
that's right. Come on down to Fredrickson, and we'll meet you. We'll hook up the mules and wagons and meet you down there.
And so that really spoke to me. So, but radio got in my blood down there. It never got out. And about 10 years ago, when internet radio came to life, I decided, along with a couple of other folks, that we'd see if the internet was maybe really the future that everybody said it was. And so far, it kind of has been, because the difference is, I get music from time to time. I'll get emails or contact on Facebook or whatever. You know, will you listen to this? Will you play this? And that can happen on the internet now, Rick, where it can't happen in commercial radio anymore. Seems like the radio that I grew up with is dead.
Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And it's sad that it's dead, but of course it is. And I tell people all the time, I must have had 50 interviews over the last week and a half or 2 weeks. I tell people all the time, I said, well, the music people in my business, in the music business, are on their knees today. They are having a really counts in making it. Because musicians, even though they get $176, $176 for every 3 hours they work in the studio, for me, which is union scale, but at the same time, they may not get a call but once every 3 months. Well, you can't live on that.
No.
You can't live on that kind of money. You know, nobody can raise a family with that.
Well, and you know, I went to school with Patterson Hood, and of course the drive-by truckers are huge, but they're huge primarily by touring, and the same thing goes for Jason
by
Isbell.
Touring and selling the records out of the trunk of their car.
And that's a far cry from the days of Leonard Chess and Jerry Wexler and the folks out at Capitol, isn't it?
No doubt about it. Well, I did a lot of work with Leonard and did a lot with Ahmet Erdogan and of course Jerry Wexler and Clive Davis and all of them and Joe Smith and you know on the West Coast. I was with Capitol Records for a while and then my label was distributed by them. I had my own promotion staff and the whole thing, and we were really taking off, you know. But you know, it's hard to have a hit record. Then it's harder to collect your money after you have a hit record. It's hard to break a hit record today, and we still do it, and I'm doing it now with you, the old-fashioned way, which is, my son said to me, he said, man, you got an old-fashioned phone there. I said, look here, son, I'm an old-fashioned man.
I'm still
doing it the old-fashioned way, you know.
So are y'all, is everything digital at Fame now? Or is there
is digital, but we can go digital or we can go on a 16 or 24 track, either one. Man, well, we have two recording studios.
Because, I asked you that because, you know, there's all the difference in the world between what comes off of a CD or an MP, God knows the compression on an MP3, and what you get out of an analog device. Do you have a preference?
Yes, I love analog still, you know, because all of my biggest hit records were on analog and I grew up on them and so, here's the difference. You probably know this, but I'll tell you anyhow. If you're on analog, a 24 track recorder, with a 2-inch piece of tape in it, the difference in the sound is this. On analog, you can get, you can go as low as about 40 cycles. And you can go as high as 15,000 cycles. Now, On, if I'm going on a Pro Tools, going to Pro Tools, then all I can get is about as low as I can get is 100 cycles, and the highest I can get is 10,000 cycles. So you're losing a lot of the top end and the very bottom end. So it's not quite as warm to me. The records aren't quite as warm to me, and it's listenable, you know. I mean, ears get tired quicker listening to high frequency sounds and all that mid range, you know.
And the fact of the matter is, the sound that you were responsible for crafting, that had everybody and their cousin running to Muscle Shoals, was funky. It was greasy, if you will. And
it was funky and greasy and gut bucket, you know. But it had a lot of emotion in it, and that was the difference in our music back then and the music today. Well,
can I ask you this? Now, this may be a silly question,
sir, go ahead.
But if you had the opportunity, would you throw every piece of auto tune software in the Tennessee River and have done with it?
Would I do what, Bob?
I just asked auto tune. You know, you hear that all over the place now. People who can't carry a tune in a bucket and hook up to a little bit of software, and the next thing you know, they sound like a clarinet. Is that offensive to your aesthetic? The vocal manipulation.
Oh, it's terrible. It's terrible to me. The fact is, if you can make a Bill, well, why don't you just bring a banjo player in and let him play an authentic banjo? And if you can make a harmonica sound like strings, then why don't you just bring strings in and overdub your stuff on strings, with strings?
You know, you mentioned something earlier about the fact that the house band that you put together, the session band, and you've put together several. You mentioned Peanut Montgomery earlier. I grew up listening to Peanut Montgomery and George Jones have it out some nights next door to me, because they'd get late in the night on a songwriting binge, and well, there's other binging involved too, I'm sure you know. it was real interesting from time to time. But
I bet it was.
But the fact of the matter is, the music you said earlier, everybody was self-taught. How do you pull something like that together when you don't have arrangements sitting in front of everybody?
Well, you have number charts, and we use the 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 numbers, you know, for charts, and it's easier. But of course, here's the natural thing. If I have to copy somebody else's part, then I'm a copier, and I can't be original being a copier. If I'm copying somebody's sound, like George Jones or whoever it might be, Eddie Arnold, anybody else, or Arthur Alexander or Aretha Franklin, you know, if I copy them, I can't get arrested with that music, because you already got one person, Les. You already got one Aretha Franklin. You don't need two. And so nobody wants to buy the records, and nobody wants to play the records. But the fact of the matter is, the human element is the thing we all thrived on. And what we done was, we, instead of one guy going into a basement with a pro tool and playing all the instruments and making a string machine, or making a device of some sort sound like violins, we went and used the real thing. I'd go to California and put strings on my stuff and hire an arranger for that. But that's the only thing we did in L.A., and that's the only thing we overdubbed. The rest we did in muscle shows, and we did it in my Fame Recording Studios, which is the oldest studio in the world now, and that's owned by the same group of people, which is my family. Now, the thing is, when you go in with a group of musicians and you use the best musicians you can find, depending on the song you're doing, and if it's a quartet, you want a quartet backing it up. And if it's gospel, you want it to sound gospel as much as possible. So the tune dictates what instruments you use and who plays them. I'll give you an example. If we walk in with Wilson Pickett and we've got a tune called Mustang Sally, and we start playing it, me as the record producer, which is always what I've done, I engineered and produced all of my records and engineered all of them. So I would go in the control room and I'd say, wait a minute, the guitar player, Travis Womack, is on the guitar. He's got the lick, man. He's got the lick that really, really, that I love. So everybody change what they're doing and follow him. And so that's how we cut records. And what we would do, I'd bring him up into the control room and say, look, let me play this back for you, because we are cutting a number one record. And, of course, they would all get bug-eyed, you know, and I'd say, well, look, listen to this. And then let's go out and refine it and put the finishing touches on it. So that's how we worked. Now, that ain't the way that New York and Los Angeles worked. They had an arranger come in, and they paid him, you know, I don't know, $10,000 or $15,000 to do the arrangements for four tunes. And they would do what he wrote. Now, if he was wrong, everybody's wrong. But in my case, we had five or six guys who voted unanimously, hey, I love what we're doing here, but I'm going to change my facelift just a little bit to make it fit the groove a little better. So that's how it worked with us, and so that's why our music sounds different from other people, and why we had so many hit records. I think that's why we had so many hit records. That and the fact that we had to be great, or we'd be working at a pie factory Monday morning or at McDonald's.
Well, you know, I just had a note from Carol, who was listening, and she said, Rick, he's talking about music that appealed to the working class. We were raised in a dirt poor white home listening to the blues and jazz. My father worshipped the artists with whom Rick Hall worked. The music was so relatable, and there's something so cathartic about the blues.
Incredible. Amen to that. Amen to all of that. That's great.
There's a cleansing quality to it, and I think maybe that's what first attracted Jerry Wexler, and of course after things soured with him, you hooked up with Leonard Chess, and tell folks a little bit about the Etta James experience.
Well, I went to Chicago after I had my falling out, so to speak, with Jerry Wexler, I went up there looking for another gig and for another act that I could produce, and I went to Chicago and I met with Leonard, and he said to me, well, he called me on the phone first before I went up there. He called me on the phone and said, hey, Rick, you know, why don't you do something for me? I mean, you do all this stuff for Ahmed and for Jerry Wexler in New York. Well, I'm Jewish, and so why don't you do some things for me? I said, hey, Leonard, I'd love to do some things for you. What do you got that you want me to do? And he said, well, I'd like you to do some things on Etta James. You've done such a good job on Aretha Franklin and Candy Staten and the people you're working with. So I said, I'll be happy to. So he brought her down, and it was like July or August. And was Etta came down. Now I loved Etta James. I mean, I got to tell it like it is. She was a really, really my kind of female singer. Of course, Aretha was too, but I lost Aretha, and she went on to another producer. And so I was looking for a new act. And Etta came down, and they brought a song, her and her husband, and she was pregnant with a child at the time. And she came down with two or three poodle dogs, and she had a whole trunk full of clothes that she brought with her, and she was wearing an ankle-length fur coat. And this is July and August. I'm talking about in hot weather.
Mercy.
And so Etta was... She was all about the music. She wanted to cut a hit record. So I told her, I said, I want you to cut this song one more time. And she said, Rick, I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to do this damn song one more time. I hate this damn song. I hate this song, and I hate you. Why are you making me sing this song over and over? Because it's not a hit, and I don't know why you're making me do it. And I said, well, Etta, I think it's a hit, man. Now, please bear with me and do the best you can. And so she did. She hung in there, and I saw her later on in Los Angeles at the Troubadour, and she was live there with James Taylor and several Linda Ronstadt and several others. And I remember they introduced her and said, well, you've heard Linda Ronstadt and you've heard so-and-so, but I'm going to... Now we're going to hear the real thing. This is the real Etta thing, and this is Etta James. And of course, Etta was, she brought the house down, you know, and so she was all about it.
And that song she hated was
called Tell Mama.
Yeah, it was Tell Mama. And you were right, and she was wrong.
And put her back in the music business, you know. she hated me for that song because she didn't like that song at all. But she said, So I went to see her backstage to see her in the, at the Troubadour, and she said, "Oh, Rick Hall." Said, "Let me." She hugged me and grabbed me and hugged me all over the place and said, "Bless your heart. Thank you so much. Thank you for making me do that song, man. I love you, and you were right, and I was wrong."
And Clarence Carter wasn't crazy about doing Patches either, was he?
No, he hated that song. He said, "I'm not going to do this song, Rick, because it's offensive to my people." And I said, "Well, Clarence, I mean, you know, I grew up tough just like you did. And, of course, I wasn't blind. I mean, there's a big difference in being blind and black and from Alabama. And here I was, a young white boy." But he bared with me and said, "Look, I'll tell you what we'll do. Let's spend an hour on the song, and I'll tell you, it's the number one record, Clarence, and you're going to miss one if you don't do it." And he said, "Well," I said, "let's spend an hour on it, and if you still hate it, after an hour, we'll throw it in the garbage can and find another song, okay?" He said, "You got it. Let's do it." And he said, "Let's do the song. Let's do the song, Rick. Let's do the song." So that was the first number one record he ever had, pop and R&B, and of course it was the first number one record that Atlantic had ever had, was Patches.
And
so I've had her on for my money, Bobby.
Oh yes you have, and right way more often than wrong. Dwayne Allman kind of got away, but I guess you're gonna have one snap the line once in a while.
Well, he didn't get away because he was signed to me before he was signed to anybody, and he came to my studio and said, "I want to be a guitar player for you, Rick Hall. I want to grow up to be just like you. I want to be you, just like you." And of course he was all personality, you know, and he, if you got his arm around your neck, you've had it, you know, because he could talk you into doing anything. He put his arm around your neck. Because he was a sweetheart of a guy. And so I said, "Well, I don't need any singers. I said, I might could use a guitar player every once in a while." And he said, "Well, I can play guitar." And he said, I said, "Well, I don't need anybody right now." And he said, "Well, do you mind if I put up my pup tent out here on your parking lot and hang around for a week or two and see if I can get something going?" And I said, no, man, that'd be cool. You know, why don't you do that?" So he bedded down on my parking lot and in his pup tent and stayed there for about 2 weeks. And he got a gig here and a gig there. And of course we had 12 recording studios in Muscle Shoals at the time. And so he went from place to place and he'd talk them into using him on the session and this and that and the other. So we had a good time. But no, he did Hey Jude with me with Wilson Pickett. And that was the beginning of Southern Rock. We had the first Southern Rock hit record, which was called Hey Jude by Wilson Pickett.
Another one where there was some pushback. Well, I tell you what, this could go on, and I would gladly do the spend the next two hours and probably two or
well,
three
you
more days.
Have the recorder on, Bobby.
Well, I do, and this will be available for folks. A lot of folks listen live, and a lot of folks listen in delay via podcast.
Well, I want to ask you one favor.
Yes, sir.
I want people, your listening audience, to please buy my book. I've got a new book, and it's the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say. If you saw the CD, then you'll want to buy the book, because the CD cut me off in 1972, and that's the year that I was voted by Billboard magazine as the number one record producer in the whole world.
Yes, indeed, and I've got it right here in front of me. The Man from Muscle Shoals.
Yeah.
My Journey from Shame to Fame. It is out from Heritage Builders Books. It will be released. I've got an advanced copy, but it'll be released here in the very near future, I was told.
It's out now. You can get it now by going to Fame. FAMEFAME2.com. You can buy it there.
Oh, wonderful.
And you'll be the first one to have a copy of it. But it's a great book.
And oh, it is a magnificent book.
It took me 10 years to write it.
and a lifetime to live it, right?
Yes, sir. And it's all about my life, and it's from start to finish. You can read all about.
And the thing is, there is so much more in the book than we have even begun to touch on.
Oh, you can't imagine.
I hope folks will go out and buy it and read it. And I was noticing the name. There was another name on the book there, and this is all like old home week for me, Rick, because I saw Terry Pace's name there.
Terry Pace is a co-writer with me.
And Terry used to do the news at WVNA when I would jock the afternoon shift on the AM there. So I consider him a dear friend, and of course he is a monumental journalist in his own right.
Well, I got to tell you something that's going to break your heart. Terry just had a stroke, and he cannot talk or write anymore.
Oh. I had seen that on Facebook, and I've been following his rehab, but I hate
well,
to hear that.
Well, he's better now. He's much better, and he can still. The one word he can say is "wow."
Oh, well, he's a
wow,
mighty good and special man, and
sweet man, and
a special place. And Rick Hall, I thank you so very much. You've been extremely generous with your time. We signed on for 45 minutes, and you gave me an extra 17, and I sure do thank you for it.
Well, Bob, you don't know how grateful I am to you, and it's wonderful to hear from you again, and from old home folks down here. But good luck to you in the future, and thank all your listeners for me. I hope they buy the book.
I do too.
If they do, I'll be grateful. So that's where I'm at, But thank you, sir. Thank you so much, and thank you, and I love you very much.
Thank you very kindly, Rick Hall. I appreciate it, and you have my undying respect and admiration, and I wish you well. I hope the book sells a million copies, or, well, let's go for two. And,
well, it's going to sell a lot of copies. I'm going to tell you, it's hot. We sold $13,000 worth this past Saturday in 3 hours at the Fame Recording Studios. So it's I'm going to be traveling with it all over the country.
Well, if your travels bring you anywhere near West Virginia, I hope you'll have your folks give me a holler, because I'd love to come down and say howdy.
Let me tell you this before I hang up. I love the Virginias. Me and my wife go up there on our vacation just about every year, and we shop for apples, and we go to all the old homesteads and all the Civil War memorial places and all that stuff, but we're crazy about Virginia. We've been up there 5 times in 5 years, and we'll probably go in this year. Probably go up there. But I'll look you up if I do come up there.
I sure would. I sure would love it. Rick Hall, you have a wonderful evening, and again, thank you very kindly. You have absolutely made my night.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate you, and thank you, sir. I appreciate you so very much.
Bye now.
Bye.
And that, of course, the one and only, almost indescribable, Rick Hall, founder, proprietor of Fame Recording Studios, Muscle Shoals, Alabama. Brand new book out and moving nicely, it sounds like. It is a memoir. There are details in there, like I said, that we didn't even begin to touch upon. And couldn't have, honest to God, couldn't have if we had had the next 2 hours to do it in. If you love soul, if you love R&B, if you love country. I mean, Mac Davis, remember Mac Davis? Mac Davis became a household name through the efforts of Rick Hall. Golly Moses. There is still, and this is an interesting piece of trivia, Rick Hall still has an unreleased Liza Minnelli album that, because of contractual disputes, disasters, and generalized nightmares, never saw the light of day. Rick Hall's the only one who knows what that album sounds like. The Osmonds, Paul Anka. Eventually, because and we didn't even get into the rather acrimonious split with his house band, the Swampers. But through what Rick Hall did, everybody and their cousin came to Muscle Shoals. Bob Dylan, he mentioned, Paul Simon, the Stones. Can you imagine? And I wanted to ask him whose job it was, but that was a dry count. Those were dry counties back then. Can you imagine being the person in charge of acquiring booze for the Stones, for Keith in particular, in a dry county? But Wild Horses was cut there. This was at Muscle Shoals Sound, not at Fame. But the book is wonderful. It is all in a very much a conversational style, and it begins before Rick Hall was born. He and I, by the way, share a birthday. He's exactly 31 years older than me. It starts before he was born and comes up to the present day, and it is, it's more than an autobiography. It's more than a memoir. It's like what Dr. Bill talks about. It is a primary source document for the history of a pretty big hunk of rock and roll and R&B and soul, country, pop, history. One of the questions I wanted to ask but didn't get around to, it must have been an absolute mind-blowing experience, or maybe not, because maybe they weren't just quite that. They weren't then what they would become. But Rick talked about Arthur Alexander. Well, within about 2 weeks of each other, the Beatles did this.
Bobby, Arthur, sell me real fine. You get better each time. Okay?
They covered this song.
Anna, you come and ask me, girl, to set you free, girl. Say he loves you more than me. Well, I will set you free. Go with him. Go with him.
So that's Anna. And within about 2 weeks' time, along comes Mick and Keith and Brian and Charlie. Yeah. And this. Arthur Alexander again.
Me to give up the hand of the girl I love. You tell me I'm not the man she's worthy of. But who are you to tell her who to love? That's up to her. Yes, there's the Lord above. You better move on. Well, I know you can buy her a fancy clothes and diamond rings, but I believe she's happy with me.
And everybody thought that was the British invasion. Oh, mercy. That's just... I'm absolutely blown away by the conversation we just had. Again, the man from Muscle Shoals, Rick Hall, my journey from shame to fame. And I mean, this This is a movie all by itself. Never mind the documentary Muscle Shoals. This life is a film. Golly, Moses. Southern Gothic. William Faulkner, Eudora Welty, could not, in their wildest imaginings, have written this. And yet it's real. So, fame2.com, and I imagine it'll be popping up at Amazon and other outfits as well, but right now, on sale online, fame2.com. And so we'll kind of reboot things and get back into the ordinary, everyday business of the horn after a little break. Let's see. That's a little more Muscle Shoals music. Yeah, he mentioned this. You're listening to Conversation Radio, listener-supported. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Yeah, that was the perfect little cap to it all. Wilson Pickett, Mustang Sally. 14 minutes past the hour, a reminder, we do try to keep all this going via listener contributions, and we still need to raise $150 this evening in any form, any combination. However, there's no such thing as too little or too small, or too big for that matter. $5, whatever. It's just important that we keep up, because we're actually a little bit out ahead right now and might get to actually come even with all the bills for a change, which would be lovely. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey.
It's Jeff from Stiller Country.
Hey, what's happening, Jeff?
Good conversation. You know, a couple months back, PBS station down in Morgantown showed special, you know, that was covering that whole deal.
Yeah, Muscle Shoals, the documentary, which is awesome.
Oh, yeah. And I think your conversation got over more material than they did in an hour.
But oh, God, there's so much more. There is so much more.
Oh, yeah. You know, I wanted to call so bad last night when you were talking to Jim and you started on tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to rub in what I had for dinner.
Oh, no. Hurt me. Hurt me.
Yeah, well, no, yeah. Well, when I turned the garden down at the end of the summer, turns out some of the tomatoes I had put in the compost pile started to sprout. So I put a pot in the basement under a nice bright fluorescent light, and I had my first winter tomato last night for dinner.
What?
Yeah. It wasn't very big, but it was good.
At this time of year, if it had been the size of a BB, it would have been heaven in your mouth.
Yeah, well, it went good in the salad, I'll tell you that. And it was nice and meaty. It wasn't too juicy. Had a nice, good, sweet taste, but not too much acid.
What kind was it, do you know?
Well, as far as I can remember, I think it was a Better Boy.
And it had to be, and for being, you know, being the 24th of March in Pittsburgh, it had to be. I'm surprised it wasn't a Best Boy.
Well, I've got the plant sitting right in front of me in the TV room, and I've got about 25 more fruits on it, and one of them's starting to yellow up now. So now it gets some actual daylight.
Oh my! And I don't know what it's like 150 miles or 200 miles north, but we got up 75 degrees today.
You know, we get up to 66.
That's respectable.
And that's good. I think we usually run about 10 degrees lower than you.
That sounds about right. So is the ground all ready to go?
No. It was cold enough that it's gotten a little stiff. I'm not ready to go out there and start digging it yet. And I think we're going to have another week of rough weather here soon.
I saw the snowflake icon on Saturday. I about threw my phone.
Yeah, well, we got about an inch or so the other night, and it was all melted the next day. So no big deal. But the last thing I want to do is start go out there and put things in the ground and have them die on you.
Oh, there's nothing more frustrating than that. Yeah, we got a saying down here that nobody in their right mind puts a tomato plant in the ground until after Mother's Day.
Yeah, well, I was sort of lucky because I'm in like a 120-year-old house, and we don't have a basement. We got a cellar.
You know? Ooh.
And I don't think it was above 55 all winter. And photosynthesis doesn't really work that well unless you get above 65.
No, and with something like a tomato, you want a constant soil temperature. I always heard around 72 degrees.
Yeah. Yep.
Of course, you say you've got a cellar. That immediately makes me think, somebody needs to be brewing some beer.
Yeah, well, I've got a big barrel for doing wine, but
When you can actually cellar condition beer after you've bottled it, oh my goodness, about 6 weeks and all gets right with the world in a hurry.
Oh, yeah. I thought it was really interesting, you know, talking to somebody that's been in the music industry for a while, and, you know, you've been around the best of the industry, and he still loves analog. And I've still got my open reel tape. I've still got my turntable. And it's like, you know, I can't listen to anything better than that.
Oh, I love analog. I mean, of course, I grew up on it too. I had to learn how to deal with digital stuff. But everything he said is the absolute gospel truth. You know, the warmth and everything that comes off of a mic'd amp. Something happens to it when it gets digitized, because you know we don't hear digitally. We hear, you know, the human ear is an analog structure.
Yeah, and the thing is, you know, when you're talking about sound reproduction, and I spent my whole life in electronics, and the thing is, everything in the electronic section of sound reproduction can be made absolutely 100% clean, but it all comes down to the transducers, changing the energy from mechanical to electronic and electronic back to mechanical. And you know, when you get those front and back ends right, you know, it's very easy to make everything in between perfect, but still screw it up if you don't get one end right or the other. So it's like, you know, I've got friends that have spent $5,000 for a microphone. And one of the guys I used to work with patented a speaker design, single driver, full range, and I was willing to put up $2,500 to buy a pair of his prototypes, just so he would have some money to keep developing it. And you wouldn't believe the accuracy and the transparency that's possible when you actually throw out all of the engineering crap that you might have learned and go back to absolute basics, you know, how does sound reproduce? And you know, it's a simple matter of, you know, the speed of sound in a material is dependent on its density and its thickness. And what you want to do to get the most accurate reproduction of sound from a speaker is to be able to transmit that energy equally through all frequencies, but, you know, with no phase transposition and stuff like that. And all of these speaker designs with crossovers and multiple drivers and all of that, you're just adding problems to the system in reproducing the sound.
Well, yeah, and of course that walks us into the whole the whole swamp of audiophilia.
Unfortunately, I've lived in that my whole life.
You know, the speaker people who will go, screw that. I mean, I'm missing a hertz here.
Yeah, well. No, it's not all about frequency response either. You know, it's about how those frequencies relate to each other, because every musical note from every instrument, you know, generates multiple frequencies with every note that are generated with a certain relationship to one another. And when you start distorting that by delaying one harmonic from another, just even the slightest amount, it makes a noticeable difference in how real that sound is. And you know, that's what most of these engineers don't understand. It's like, you know, every time you put a capacitor or a choke in a circuit, you're delaying one frequency and advancing another, and you know, they all interrelate. So if you, the more you complicate the system, the more likely you are to create problems than to, you know, overcome them. That's why my mother was nuts for buying all this equipment. So she's got these Bose Wave radios and all this stuff. And, you know, to a casual listener, a Bose might sound good, but when you really sit down, you take live music and listen to it through one of their systems. It's like, it's unrealistic. It's just garbage, you know, compared to a really good system.
Oh, without a doubt. And of course, I get notes from John Fox every now and then saying, and that's why we're working so hard to bring put the new-ish equipment into line here. I'll get notes from John Fox and from some other folks too saying, you know, Bob, that preamp on your mic is leaving. it's dying a slow, painful death, and you need to just let it go.
I noticed, I think I saw on Facebook that you liked, what is it? This Is Hell, the radio show out of Northwestern University?
Yeah.
I don't know if you've noticed, but I listen to them consistently. But, you know, over the past couple of months, it's like whatever they're doing with sending their stream downline, the audio is so low, I have to crank everything up.
Well, and sometimes there's stuff in dealing with, I guess we're kind of off in the weeds now, Jeff, but that'll be all right. There's stuff that goes on here that is so far different from traditional radio, which is complicated enough as it is. But you know what I'm talking about when I say, you know, when I talk about normalizing the board, you know, making sure that that everything runs basically at the same or similar levels. Screw yourself to the moon trying to do that when you're crossing out of a board through a computer and into another computer and then up to a server, which is where you guys are getting it from. Sometimes I think it's a modern miracle that by the time we're all done with it, the broadcast isn't coming out in Swahili.
Yeah, well, I'm so used to analog boards, you know, it's like I don't know anything about that, especially since I quit working in 2000.
Well, I mean, this is an analog board that we're on here, but it eventually has to become digital. And so, you know, you get into the swamp pretty quick.
Yeah, well, I guess I'll cut Kathy Malloy some breaks then, because she tends to seem not quite in control of levels.
I know a little bit about what's going on down there, and I worship Kathy Malloy, because I'd run screaming naked into the night trying to do what she does, because she's not just sending a stream out to the White Rose like we are. She's sending a stream to live stream, and she's sending one up to the bird too.
Yeah,
and my eyes had crossed trying to monitor all those levels at the same time.
Yeah, well, I guess it's an added complexity every time you add another stage into what you're trying to do. But it's great that they're doing it.
And then what happens is every so often, because so far, and some of that's changing by God, thanks to the Horn Family Commune Congregation. But every so often, the geniuses out in Washington State at the Microsoft compound decide to redo how their computers handle sound.
Yeah,
and
I know.
I remember when we went from XP to 7, I was my eyes crossed. And then Windows 8, I can barely stand to say the words, because it just makes me want to put my foot through the. And it's not the machine's fault. It's as far as I can tell, the sound interface is being designed by people who sell shoes.
Yeah, well, the fun part of that, from somebody that's on the receiving end of the whole deal, is I remember I used to be able to record live streams as they came in, but with I think it was somewhere around the Service Pack 3 on XP that they changed it so that any live streaming, you can't record through the same sound card. And it's like, oh, gee, thank you very much. Now I've got to jump through hoops to send it, you know, through another loop so that I can record it from this input instead of that input.
And we went through that. It used to be For instance, you called in on what we refer to shorthand as the Skype line, but as of last night, we have renamed Harold because it apparently confuses people. But it used to be that we didn't have a second computer to run Skype. Skype just came through, and we used the second sound card on the production PC. Well, with the advent of Windows 8, you can't do that.
Yeah,
because Skype runs only as an app.
Yeah, I don't like to talk about my computers. They're pretty much dead as it is, and I'm still with XP Pro, and I'll not buy another Microsoft product. So,
I understand.
But I'll let you get out of the weeds.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed the tomato. Think of me when the next one comes ripe. And resist the urge to pluck the green ones and fry them before. You only have fried green tomatoes at the end of the season, right?
Yeah, that was one of my mother's favorites, but not so much for me. I like mine red and juicy.
Oh, on a BLT with like some fabulous Benton's bacon from East Tennessee, when the juice from the tomato marries up with the mayonnaise, oh, stop it.
Yeah, well, I'll stick with my local grocer. They've got their own butcher shop, and they do their own slab bacon, and it's nice and thick, like an eighth or 3/16 of an inch thick, and it's just lean as hell, but it's so good.
Well, and now I'm hungry.
Food porn.
Oh, I'm gonna so love my gas station pizza at the end of the evening. Yum, yum. Hey, Jeff, have yourself a good evening. I'm glad you called.
You take care. Everybody have fun.
All right. Bye now. Our buddy Jeff calling from the Pittsburgh area. Both lines open if you want to get involved in the conversation. 304-574-8178. That's Harold, otherwise known as the Skype line. 304-663-HORN, 304-663-4676. That's Maud. Thank you, Marty. Otherwise known as the Gizmo Line, 304-663-HORN. And your responses to the conversation with Rick Hall or anything else that may happen to be on your mind is all welcome fodder for conversation. And right here's the man I've been waiting to hear from. Hey, Bill.
Hey.
How are you?
A minute ago, Bob. I'm just delighted with what you men talked about tonight.
I kind of had a feeling it would be a treat for you.
Well, I had the wrong person. I guessed that you were going to have somebody who's a close friend of one of the Horn family people. I thought he was going to be here. See, I didn't really know how deep you were into the DJing end of music, you know, or radio, in fact, of any kind, you know.
Yeah.
You were deep.
And the thing is, at the time I was doing, I had no idea who I was working around. I mean, I had an idea, but it's just where you are. Those were the people. And you know, there was a progression of people that marched in and out of those radio stations. Like, well, howdy, how pleased to meet you. Yeah. It's real special. And by the way, I thought you'd get a kick out of knowing that. As Rick Hall spent considerable amount of time, it's obvious that he loved his daddy very much, and he spent a considerable amount of time talking about his daddy and his work and everything. There's a chapter 24 of the book begins, "Dad had been working up north in Cleveland for about a year when he realized how lonely we had grown without him, and he couldn't bear to be separated from us any longer. He was making good money in Cleveland and was saving most of it, but when he came back to Alabama and saw how hard Uncle George was working me and how frail I was, he couldn't bear to leave us behind anymore. So we packed the few clothes we had, said our goodbyes to Uncle George and his family, and headed up north with our dad for a taste of the good life."
Oh, God. Yeah, Cleveland was a very good music city in the 50s when this guy Bill Randall was working. Because Randall recorded a lot of people. He recorded the Modern Jazz Quartet, and he went out and recorded George Lewis, the New Orleans clarinet player, and he introduced Elvis on his Tommy Dorsey show, which, you know, they talk about Ed Sullivan, you know?
Right.
And the and how Ed Sullivan, Brian Elvis on TV, tells Bells. I saw him with the, Jackie Gleason's summer. Tony Dorsey took over the show in the summer. And Dorsey didn't much care for Elvis, and then I saw Elvis on the Milton Berle show on a Tuesday night before he ever was with Ed Sullivan. But people forget this kind of stuff quickly, and I sure would have loved to see who else he worked with down there that were, of course, I don't know what studio, but I thought, I'm pretty, Albert King always used the muscles, Shoals horn section behind him.
Yeah.
And his whole band was Booker T.
All of those things crisscross and interface and backtrack over each other. Yeah, like I said, it was the son of the saxophone player for the Muscle Shoals horns who first taught me how to run a mixing board, and for that matter, how to run an auditorium lighting system, and how to set up a PA system and Pee-wee baseball. With the son of the they went on to be known as the Swampers, with the son of their drummer. And for me, the amazing thing and the inspiring thing is that we're not talking about a bunch of guys who came out of some conservatory of music. We're talking about people. Nope. We're talking about people who learned to play on dime store instruments and just loved the art. And ate it and slept it and breathed it. I mean, Jesus, did Duane Allman camped out in the parking lot of Fame Studios?
There's on Mustang Sally, there's a baritone,
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it's a baritone. And I said, man, that guy is just at the right place. It's like somebody, you stand at the top of the stairs and somebody gives you a nudge and down you go, It was just a real trigger. How the hell he mixed that stuff, I'll never know. When Capitol sent me a contract, it was just a piece of crap, Bob. Just no guarantee of release and no producer. And I had the temerity and the stupidity to call them and say, hey, what is this? You guys are going to own me for 3 years, and you're not going to give me some professional help that I need. I said, I've only got 3 or 4 years of leadership behind me, and I'm no recording engineer. I mean, I was fooling around with tape early because my dad fooled around. My dad's brother was a technician. The guys he worked for in the pinball business, they called him the man with the golden hands. Because he could fix almost anything. I wasn't that good, that's for sure. I had to go work on his TV when he was starting to get into the next stop for him was, the nursing home, And so I'm working on his TV, and I'm feeling like, holy Christ, what are you doing here, Bill? This guy can eat you up. And he could. He was a master. He talked about, I had some kind of a device, you walked around the room and you set different frequency levels on a PA system.
Yeah.
EQ, equalizer.
Right.
I had an equalizer that you could set, it would set itself as you walked around the room. I didn't skimp when I was making money. I tried to buy stuff, but what I couldn't afford was to carry some guy with me to run everything for me. Just could never afford it. Just never paid that well. But he found some great people. What the hell was her name from Chess? Ed James?
Yeah.
Rumor had it that her and Leonard Chess liked each other a lot. And there was also problems with a certain commodity that's made a comeback in the United States ever since we've been fighting in Poppy Land over there. I won't keep you up. Did you ever read The Wizard of Oz?
Oh, yeah.
See the movie?
Yeah, I read the
book. Isn't it amazing when they're going through that poppy field?
Yeah, it's a, well,
it's an entirely
different account in the original book version by L. Frank Baum.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. What I'm saying is the motivation is entirely different. You know, in the movie, it's just a field of poppies, and it just makes them sleepy. Poppies will make them sleep. But as is the case with the rest of the story, it's not some harmless children's tale. It's a great big sprawling allegory for everything that L. Frank Baum felt like was going wrong in America at that period in time.
He was involved with the oil situation when the guy whose house was not far from where I live now, his estate, Mr. Rockefeller.
Yes.
His estate was not too far from where I'm sitting right now. If he was still around, he'd say, "Get that fat bastard off my lawn," you know. He'd tell me, or yelling at me. But if they built a railroad station for him not far from here so he could get off the train and get into his horse and carriage and eventually his automobile and be transported to his home. Yeah. Because they owned everything, Bob. Well, are we headed back to that again? You and I will go through that many times. But they want to go right back to that. Yeah, but I read a bio of Baum, and he was a strange guy.
Yes, he was.
He was for women's suffrage a lot. Anyway, I wish I could get this guy's book on audio because that's the problem I always have.
Well, you know what? I will reach out to the publicist who originally reached out to me, and I'll ask if there are any plans for this to be transposed into an audiobook.
Well, there's a bunch of guys who are connected to the National Library System that will they decide what goes on audio and what doesn't. I just got a good history of the first part of the Vietnam War called A Street Without Joy that covered the French. And there's another one on D&B and Fools. The same Bernard Fall wrote that too. And Fall was out in the field with the American Army when he was killed. And lately, I've been wondering: was he killed because he was there, or because of the some Vietnamese killed him, or was he killed by some American who didn't want him there? Because his whole activity and allegory about the allegory is a bad word, but his whole pointing that he was doing about the United States and Vietnam was, what the hell are you doing here? Get out of here. One American unit came very close to fighting on the same ground, the French, and I think it was in Pleiku, was a battlefield where the one French unit that had fought in Korea was just wrecked by the Vietnamese nationalists, you know. What goes around comes around, Bob. And forget hell, right?
Forget hell, yeah. 155 years later, forget hell.
Forget hell. Anyway, it was a tremendous conversation. I wish I had the ability to tape it, but I don't anymore. Because everything's... When I got moved over here, these guys are really bailing me out, but... They bailed out a few things they shouldn't have bailed out, you know. They didn't ask me first, and that doesn't sit well with me when you do something and you don't tell me you're going to do it.
Because I understand. Hey, let me. Hold on a sec. I wanted to let you know that Carol Baker just looked. The book is available at Amazon.com on Kindle, and Kindle will read to you.
Yeah, I have to invest in the Kindle system.
Once your computer's behaving itself, you can just load the Kindle app onto your desktop.
That would help because
the only thing is I don't know if the reading function works in the desktop version. Somebody will have to tell me.
Well, I live on the computer. I mean, between political talk and the National Hockey League. That's why I survived. Because pro football hasn't interested me since Paul Brown got fired here in Cleveland. I mean, I was downtown the night before they played the 64 game, and I was 21, and I found me a nice seat in the corner and watched the drunks duke it out with each other. That was like being in a John Wayne movie, you know, sitting in the corner watching these idiots fight each other over some football game. It's like that. And let's hope for West Virginia. Because the only people I have are, I like Michigan State, and it would be nice to see. West Virginia ever win the damn tournament? I think they did.
You know, the heyday of Mountaineer basketball occurred back when the NCAA tournament was on the rise, but the NIT was the real prestige tournament.
Yeah.
Now of course it's all flip flopped. Yeah.
And what kills me, Bob, is would you say that the majority of good basketball players are African American men?
Sure.
And women too, for that matter. And these same bigoted sons of bitches can sit and watch this. Because I remember when watching baseball when I was a kid at the stadium, and a guy like Larry Doby would come up to hit, and, oh, if he'd get a hit, he was the greatest. If he struck out, oh, you ought to have heard the stuff I heard.
No, I don't doubt it. And you know, that was one of the more interesting things that Rick Hall alluded to, Bill, is that there really was a colorblind culture that was working inside the halls of Hall Studio, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Absolutely. Because I was blessed with two great black bass players in my life, and the second would just sing me up an alley, you know, and in fact, Mustang Sally was one of the songs he sang for us, because this is what the people were buying, you know. They were buying stuff like that. I did Get Out of My Life, Woman. I did that one a few times and recorded it twice. And, yeah, we got into that stuff because if you could get them off the floor and make them dance, and if four songs in you wanted to play a good old-fashioned slow belly rubbing blues, you could get away with it because, you know, people were ready for it then. Of course, the fellas liked that a lot because most of these guys couldn't. They danced like me with the old three left feet, you know. I was a terrible dancer. You know, I danced around.
But when you can play a harp like you did and have the presence on stage that you did, you know, dancing would have just been gilding the lily.
Well, my father, if he had lived, would have been delighted because he was a great violinist in the gypsy Central European tradition. He could play that damn thing. And I remember at my uncle's funeral, my aunt hired a violin player. I was driving this guy around town, and what an education I got from him in a couple of days. He worked for Harpo Marx. And
holy
he said,
cow.
Yeah, he had heard Harpo speak, which is something, you know. How many of us could ever see that? And I can get Groucho shows on the old radio, and he's funnier than hell. You know, still good. Anyway, let me clear our decks for somebody else, and you hang in there on a great, great show tonight.
Well, thank you, Bill. Thank you so much.
Thanks for holding that book for me. I appreciate it.
And you know, I really am glad you enjoyed it because as soon as I booked the interview, I thought, you know, Bill's going to love this.
Well, there's things about music that and the business and the sales and, well, the payola thing was big in my lifetime, and Bill Randall's daughter used to come to hear us, and she brought him one night, and he said in his usual loud voice, that this guy's as good or better than Butterfield. And I said, well, it was hard for me to walk around the rest of the night. You can't walk 2 feet off the air, off the ground, you know, without falling to your face. Because that was for that guy to say something like that was like, yeah. Because I never got rich doing it, but if you can make a living doing something you love, which I think is something that you can relate to. Yeah, maybe you'd like to make a million for your family, but running the truth and making a living are two good things to do, you and you take care of yourself.
All right, thank you, Bill. Have a good evening. Bye now.
Good night.
Our buddy Bill, the legendary Mr. Stress, calling from Cleveland. 10 minutes before the hour, and you know, this has been such an astonishing evening. I almost feel hesitant to walk off into the swamp of some of the stuff that we ordinarily deal with. In fact, I had a note from Kate on the Front Range a little bit ago. She said, please don't contaminate the rest of the program with preacher crap. It was good to hear all the history. I could smell the river from here. Yeah. I need to get back down that way sometime soon, if it's at all humanly possible. The barbecue joint hot dog dreams are coming faster and furiouser. And it's beginning to ruin my sleep. Hey, look, it's News Ninja Carol Baker. How do you do?
It is. I can barely hear you though.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, that's better.
Okay, that's probably the dying preamp.
Sorry. No, I'm with your last note writer. I'm for a whole evening of not polluting it with the stench of the right.
How long has it been since we did that?
I don't know. I've never heard one.
What a fun little experiment that might be.
Well, you know, here was the thing is that, first of all, every time he called you Bobby, I thought I was going to die laughing. But he's such a fascinating character because you look at all of the legendary people that he's known in his life, and he's not full of himself. He's just a good old boy. You could almost like feel yourself like sitting across from a table just bullshitting with him.
Yeah, and well, like I said, the book itself is so worth having. The minute the advance copy arrived, I just started tearing through it, and I was done in a couple of days, even on my schedule. Because, like I said, this is a primary source document. This is him. You know, he doesn't write about stuff that he heard from somebody who was told by their cousin who. No, this is stuff he was in the middle of. And sure, politics is interesting, and sports is fascinating, I guess. But you know, this is really, really down on the floor with the construction, intentional or otherwise, Carol, of pop culture.
Well, it isn't often that we get to hear from, you know, let's face it, most of the people who were there in the beginning are dead or dying or went on to other things.
Well, it's a hard business.
Because it's a hard business.
And his life itself was brutal. I mean, he touched briefly on the stuff with his mama, and that tore him to pieces. Mm-hmm. But he didn't tell, and I deliberately didn't ask about some of the other stuff because he's going to tell these stories probably 150 times to 150 different radio hosts, and after a while it's going to feel kind of triggery.
Yeah.
When he was a little boy, His little brother was scalded to death when the laundry pot turned over.
Oh my!
His daddy got for all he loved his daddy, bless his heart, even had a little success and bought his daddy a tractor because he was tired of seeing how hard his daddy worked and a tractor would be the finest thing in the world. And his daddy rolled the tractor.
He did what?
He rolled the tractor.
Oh, no.
I mean, and you come from a part of the country where you know what rolling the tractor means.
It still happens. People get killed that way every year.
And then, I'm not taking anything away from the book because there's bunches of stuff between these pages. Then he marries a young girl. They're crazy about each other. They go to see a band play not too awful far from the Shoals. They're coming home. He goes to dodge a car that's coming at him head on, rolls the car, throws her out of the car, and she dies.
Oh my God!
I mean, like I said, if William Faulkner or Eudora Welty had turned in a manuscript with that, they'd say get away with it. No, that you can't. No, you can't get away with that. But it's reality. it's reality. And the rise of the prominence of his session bands. His first session band went off to Nashville after he had helped them make a name for themselves. The second session band, the Swampers, that are mentioned in Sweet Home Alabama, they decamped because he was on the verge of a huge groundbreaking deal with Warner Brothers, and they split off and went back to Jerry Wexler and formed Muscle Shoals Sound.
He
picks himself up and dusts himself off, but my God, the things that he made possible. There's a story told about how Paul Simon's people called down and says, "Hey, Paul wants that same bunch of funky black dudes that were playing on so and so's record." He said, "Well, that'll be fine. We can do that, but they're kind of pale." And like I said, the idea that these are all self-taught musicians. Tell me that happens. I mean, anymore.
Well, it doesn't happen anymore, probably. But here's the thing about music is that it doesn't matter what class you come from. It doesn't matter if you're dirt poor, if you came from a family of cotton pickers, and it didn't matter if you came from the big city. Music was one of those universally accessible things. It was for everybody, and it was free. And, you know, there were a lot of kids who couldn't afford to go out and buy the records, but you could still turn on the radio, and that music was there. And it became such a part of our lives. It's one of those things that, it's like those, you'll smell something that will remind you of something that your mother cooked, that gives you that kind of really warm memory. And when I found out who you were going to interview tonight, and I knew about the Etta James story, and I was like, Etta James is just like so iconic in our family because she was one of my dad's favorites. And I have this memory of being 4 years old. Sundays were one of the few days that he had off. You know, you don't raise a litter of kids and not work really hard. And he would get up on Sundays and he would put his favorites on the stereo and he would play it full blast and he would sing and we would sing. But I remember being 4 years old and him getting down on his knees and holding me in like that classic ballroom hold and a swing to Etta James singing Sunday Kind of Love. And I can still smell the creosote in his work shirt mixed with Lifebuoy soap and Aqua Velva.
Yeah.
It's just that kind of a thing when you hear that kind of music. And then when you get to listen to somebody and a friend of yours is talking and interviewing someone who helped shape some of the really big classic sounds, it's like, it's so exciting. I just loved that interview. That was awesome.
And I don't do them very often, Carol, and I don't know, maybe I should. It's time consuming setting them up. And a lot of times it just feels so very transactional. This one didn't.
When I did radio, that was all I did was interviews. And I know what a ginormous pain in the ass it is. And actually, that's when you and I, it was after my Ferguson experience, and you brought me on and interviewed me. And that was, and I could tell that was something that was very different for you, but you too have that way of kind of that coffee talk kind of
way. Talk amongst yourselves.
Yeah, talk amongst yourselves. And so you made it really easy because it was in some ways it was a really growing experience. In some ways it was a real painful experience. But you made it easy to talk about. So you're a good interviewer. You should do more of it.
I think I will when I see things that, and you know, I do when I see things that come my way. But oh my God, you should see what my inbox looks like. Because I'd say 99% of the stuff that comes in. Let me see if I can find one, just to give you an idea.
Mine was usually hate mail.
Well, this is more like. Here's a new press release. New O'Keefe video. Cornell Dean advises on starting ISIS Club. You know, James O'Keefe.
Yes, that little weasel.
Here's a guy that wants me to interview somebody. Are politicians practicing medicine without a license? Why the Kraft and Heinz merger is branding magic? I mean, I probably spend an hour a day, Carol, just deleting these pitches because I know that there's some guy who cannot possibly or woman, I don't want to be sexist here, who couldn't in a million years talk their way through an hour of programming without a tip sheet from a publicist. I ain't that guy.
Yeah, I actually used to go after the interviews that I wanted, and it was really one of the most remarkable things, is that people really want to talk. I expected to be turned down. Do you know that there were two people who ever turned me down? One of them was Gloria Steinem, because she just was so busy, and I actually knew somebody who knew her. It was only 2 degrees of separation, but she was so busy, and she just doesn't... At her age, she doesn't talk unless she's got an audience where she's... I mean, she only plays to the big rooms.
Right.
And I wasn't it. And there was somebody else, and I didn't care enough to remember their name, but most people said yes. I was just constantly amazed at how many people said yes.
And I can get that yes a lot of the time, and I try to be gracious when folks reach out to me for conversations, you know, relating to mountaintop removal. And try to make it as conversational as possible. There are layers, and I think you probably can attest to this, there are layers upon layers sometimes that you have to go through to get them. And if you're recording a program, but if you're recording a program and you can go back and you can edit and you're putting it all together, okay. But if you're putting together something live 3 hours a night, you know.
Yeah.
It can eat up your life in a hurry.
Oh yeah, but I always did my homework.
Oh, I have no doubt.
Yeah, I always knew who I was talking to, and I had my list of questions ready, and I knew exactly where I was going to steer the thing. So, it was a really fun thing for me, and I knew where I knew what I was doing, and got there really quickly, and ended up with some really awesome interviews. So. I just want to hear you do more. You're good at it.
Okay, this is one of those little moments when we can talk about, you know, down the road and secret ambitions and stuff. You probably, you're old enough to remember Tom Snyder and the Tomorrow Show.
Oh, gosh, yes, the Tomorrow Show. I loved that guy.
If I had my druthers and could figure out a way to do it and use modern technology with, like, Skype and video, all of that, I think it would be so cool to revive, if not the Tomorrow Show itself, because I'm sure somebody owns the rights to it, but to revive the idea of it, because Tom Snyder was, you know, one of those broken mold people. There aren't any more, and never will be. But
and he just sat there and puffed on that cigarette the whole time, and then laughed. That iconic laugh and that.
But, that one?
Yes, that one.
I'd love to recreate that, because I think it's along the lines of the format of what we work with here. And frankly, it's the kind of conversation that we had this evening. And to do that and maybe put it up on YouTube video or live on YouTube and then let it be replayed, whatever. I think it's a possible part of our future. Way back in the early days of the Horn, I did a ton of interviews.
Yeah.
And not necessarily, sometimes it wasn't on stuff that I was necessarily into, but just to be pumping out the information. And then I had this road to Damascus moment, Carol, when I realized that the people who were calling the program and just can see, yeah, thank you for taking my call, Bob, and I'm sitting there, no, thank you for making it, when I realized that a whole bunch of the time the people who call the program are a hell of a lot more interesting than Horace Schmendrick with his new book, Your Toenail Clippings and You.
I missed him. How could I miss him?
Darn the luck.
You know, it when I was out searching for stories, I found Al Jazeera English to be one of the most valuable tools for getting at what I wanted. And there was just I remember there was a real tiny story about a statistic on military sexual assault. And I must have read that 5 times because I thought, that can't be right. And we did a 3-part series and interviewed men and women in the military who had been sexually assaulted, and they came on and told their stories. And I was telling you, there was one young naval sailor. It was a young woman, and when she told her story, her name was Terry Odom. I will never forget her. And when she told her story, it was one of those days where you were glad that you had the mute feature on your microphone, because I was sobbing while she was telling this and how just utterly heartless and cruel they were. And then we got in touch with the group Protect Our Defenders, and their executive director would come on once every couple of weeks and give updates as to what was happening. I got to interview Jackie Spire, the congresswoman from California, who was absolutely at the front of this whole thing. And we had worked on this for like a couple of months before the mainstream media ever got a hold of it. And holy hell, you'd have thought this was a brand new discovery. And I'm sitting there going, we did this months ago.
Yeah, and I used to talk about how the horn could be so far out in front of the curve that it looked like straight road.
And it will be. And it will continue to be as long as we are able to have the kinds of conversations that we're able to have. There are a lot of very interesting people who call in. And yes, I know I channel Diane all the time. But the reason that I love it when Diane calls in is because she always adds this very approachable intellectual nature layer to the conversation because of her background and because of her personal experiences, coupled with the fact that she's so damn funny. So I love listening to her because I always walk away feeling like I learned something. I love it when people call in and they talk about things and you feel like it's very profound what you've just heard. And
yeah.
I'm like, you know, I'm a little smarter. Maybe I never really looked at it that way before. Because we're not conservatives and we're not stuck on stupid, we can actually broaden, you know, our thought process here.
And you know, Rick mentioned something in the conversation this evening, Carol. He said, you know, we were conservative Christian people. But lo and behold, I don't think that meant then what it means now.
I caught that, and I thought to myself, yeah, you were Christian conservatives back then when you followed the teachings of Christ the way they were written in...
And being a conservative Christian meant that you couldn't, in good conscience, pick up a rifle and go shoot people that you had nothing against.
And you didn't work on Sundays, and if somebody came to your door and they were starving, and you only had, you know, 2 eggs and, you know, a couple of pieces of bread... They got an egg and a piece of bread because that was just the Christian thing to do.
Yeah.
I get it.
But the conservatives now would pillory Rick Hall back then for being un American.
Well, that and, you know.
And I'm sorry, that's kind of off into the swamp, but we'll.
No,
we'll,
because he. And here was the thing. He was like, He heard something in the music of the African American experience you know, that was the heart of the blues, and that whole area, you know, we're talking the Deep South here. And the music was so transformative because these people's pain was so beautifully evoked in these tunes, and they were, and it was cathartic the way that they sang it. And then other poor people were listening to that music, and there was something very relatable about it. And that's what I was talking about when I said this was music for the masses. There was something so incredibly relatable to the artists that he was working with. And all I could think of was my dad would have just been in heaven listening to this tonight. He would have been calling and going, I want to talk to him. Because he would have wanted to know what so-and-so was like, you know, or he would have had a question about a cut on a certain album, or, you know, because he knew this.
Well, Lord, I mean, some of the stuff we didn't get into, Carol, when Aretha Franklin came down, she had just gotten out of her contract with CBS, because CBS was just wasting her. They were trying to turn her into like a female Nat King Cole.
Yeah.
And it wasn't working.
What a waste.
And so she comes down there. They work in that organic fashion that he described. They work through a couple of songs. And along the way, Aretha's husband decides he doesn't like somebody in one of the side men in the session, and demands he be fired on the spot. And the whole thing boils up and boils over and broils until Rick winds up in a fight with the guy. And of course, I think there was liquor involved on both sides.
Can't imagine.
And Aretha Franklin's husband went to the airport and just left her.
Oh.
And that's why the rest of the album gets recorded elsewhere. But that very first track, I Never Loved a Man the Way I Love You, changed everything for her. And of course, that's the title. That's also the title track of the album. And I think Respect is on that album too. But it, you know, and that goes on to become a feminist anthem.
Well, but his creative genius was in letting people be who they were. He wasn't trying to turn her into a female Nat King Cole. He wanted her to be Aretha Franklin.
Right.
Because he saw and heard that beautiful, raw, feminist, powerful, gravelly Aretha.
Yeah, that's all you can say, Aretha. And
yeah,
and the,
because there isn't any other word for it.
And the other stuff that's out there, Jerry Reed,
mm-hmm.
And I keep going back to Duane Allman, and what it must have felt like when. Can you imagine being Arthur Alexander and getting tracks cut by the Beatles and the Stones within a month of each other? Of course,
yeah.
It's 1964, and who knows, that maybe they're one-hit wonders. But I mean, I don't think anybody thought the Beatles or the Stones were going to be one-hit wonders.
I actually got to interview one of the guitarists that worked with Paul McCartney. His name was Lawrence Jewell.
Oh, yes.
And he has played with Tommy Emmanuel, who is like...
Oh, I'm a Tommy fan.
I am a huge Tommy fan. That what that guy can do with a guitar is not human. And just to talk to him, and he was another one of those kind of really earthy guys, and he was getting ready to do this series of concerts, and none of the tickets were over $24. Because he wanted the music to be accessible to the masses. And I'm sitting there going, this is exactly the kind of guy I want to talk to.
Right, yeah. And, back in the days of my midlife crisis, we call those the Porsche years, one of my favorite things in the world, I had, what is the name of that Tommy Emmanuel album? It's got a track on it called Chasing the Invisible Man or something like that. It's before he hooked up with Chet Atkins. There it is. The Journey. Tailing the Invisible Man.
Yeah.
And I had this huge Rockford Fosgate amp that was directly underneath the driver's seat, and these audiophile quality speakers, and I would just howl down the road in my Porsche 911 with that thing cranked to 11. He's a brilliant, and Lawrence Juber did work with Paul McCartney famously, so. And then you know what a weird little Al Stewart fanboy I am.
Oh yeah.
Well,
I don't get it, but I get it.
It's the historical thing and the awesome lyrics. Well, about 10-15 years ago, he did an album called Between the Wars that Lawrence Juber is on, and it's, you know, he gets dual billing, or gets equal billing on the
nice.
Record. And the guitar work in there is absolutely stunning.
If you ever get a chance, go to YouTube and YouTube Tommy Emmanuel playing Classical Gas.
Oh, God. Yeah.
And he was trying to teach somebody how to do what he was doing. And the guy finally just laid down his guitar and put his hands up and said, I can't do it. But do it, because I have to see this. Just stop trying to teach me. Just do it. And as I said, what he does with that guitar is not human. It is like 10 guys with guitars playing all at once.
Yeah, the same thing happens for me listening to Al Di Meola.
Yeah, without the noise,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's just brilliant stuff. So, yeah. Yeah.
In fact, I'm
glad Bill called in, too, because the whole time this was going on, I was thinking, oh, God, Bill's going to love this.
And I think he did. He mentioned when Capitol offered him a contract, and it was a bunch of crap. Just not to, but can you imagine Bill signing the contract and winding up working with Rick Hall? I mean,
yeah, exactly. That would have been pretty epic.
A little bit, yeah.
A lot bit. For sure. Anyway, enough of this music talk, but I just wanted to call and say congratulations. Awesome interview.
Thank you.
And that was some good memory stuff there, and I cannot wait to read the book.
And I take it you've already ordered?
It's on the Kindle already.
Isn't Kindle awesome?
It is awesome.
Hey, well, do you know the answer to that before we do go, Carol?
What?
If you use the desktop app, does it have the reader function, or do you have to have a Kindle device itself?
I've never tried it, because I'm just such a reader that I've never even tried the audio part of it, so I can't answer that. But I do know that they have the cloud. They have the Kindle Cloud app that you can just download right to your desktop, and all the books go straight to there, and you start reading it immediately.
If the vocal reader works on the desktop, that would be perfect for Bill, because, well, he wouldn't have to buy a Kindle device.
Bill, I'm going to look into that for you. I'm going to see if I can download it onto my Mac, and because I haven't ever had a need to, because I've got it on the iPad and on the Kindle. So, but I will find out, and as soon as I find out, I will let you know, and you can let Bill know.
Yeah, absolutely. Just see if that speech function is there.
Yeah, the text-to-speech. I'll see what I can do for you, Mr. Bill.
Because you're a giver.
Because I'm a giver, damn it.
Yes, you are. Carol Baker, have yourself a lovely evening.
And you, sir.
And good night. Thank you for the mighty kind words.
You too.
Bye now.
Bye.
Giver in chief, that is News Ninja Carol Baker. About 20 minutes past the hour, and just another little break, because why not? Like I said, you know, a lot of pop, a lot of R&B. You remember the Osmonds singing "One Bad Apple Don't Spoil the Whole Bunch, Girl"? Yeah. Wasn't that the Osmonds? One Bad Apple? Before Donnie's voice changed? Yeah, that's Rick Hall and Fame Recording Studios. But this one, just a good example of what happened on the other side of the pop culture divide, if you will. Another little bit of Muscle Shoals music.
This is our national anthem, and it goes like this. She got the gold mine and I got the shaft. Well, I guess it's back in 63 when eating my cooking got the better of me, and I asked this little girl I was going with to be my wife. Well, she said she would, so I said I do, but I'd have said I wouldn't if I'd have just knew how saying I do was going to screw up all of my life. First few years went all that bad. I'll never forget all the good times we had. Of course, I'm reminded every month when I send her the child support. And it wasn't very long till the lust all died, and I'll admit I wasn't too surprised the day I come home and see my suitcase sitting out there on the porch. I tried to get in, and she changed her lock. And I seen this note on the mailbox that said, "So long, turkey. My attorney will be in touch." Well, I decided then and there to do what's right, give her her fair share. I just didn't know it was going to be that much. Well, she got the gold mine. I got the shaft. They said this getting it all down the middle, but she got the bigger half. It all sounds mighty funny, but it hurts too much to laugh. She got the gold mine, and I got the shaft. That's funny, ain't it?
Yeah, the live version, the great Jerry Reed. It is 21 minutes past the hour. The swamp seems like such a scary and icky place to go. But I guess we'll have to wander over sooner or later. It's that or read the newspaper. You know. Both lines are open. Area code 304-663-HORN. Area code 304-663-4676. That's the Gizmo line, otherwise known as Maud. The Skype line, which you don't have to have Skype to use, also known as Harold, is 304-574-8178. Either one works just dandy. Skype to Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn. That gets you into the program on a Skype to Skype basis. No toll charges, no phone charges. Hell, no phone. And you're welcome to jump right in. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello.
What's happening, Jim?
Hello, are you there?
I am quite.
Oh, your volume is real low.
The preamp's dying.
Oh, sorry about that. Well, it's technology crown, so it crucifies, right?
Yep. No, and you know what the sign says at the top of the thing? INRI. I'm nailed right in.
Great program. Really, you should do more of them. The guy was just fascinating. From shame to fame. I mean, good Lord.
And
I would imagine he has done quite well in his business.
Oh, he's a giant. An absolute giant. I mean,
I never heard of this person. I mean, I've heard of things like Sun Records, and I'm not really familiar with a lot of that type of music or whatever.
Well, Sun was huge because Sun was in many ways first. Because again, Sam Phillips comes out of the Shoals too. That's what makes that area so incredibly special. It's hard to think. Who knows why that place is like it is? But like I said, for me, it's like Brigadoon.
Well, it's definitely a confluence of a lot of things, that's for sure. And your reference to Brigadoon and going back to, the story of Brigadoon going back to the 16th century and that type of thing to a better place, enjoyed by so many. Yeah. It's definitely a cogent reference.
Well, you'd have to, and really, I've heard that there are people who want to, that I guess it's, especially as a result of the documentary Muscle Shoals, and if you want to see Rick Hall as well as hear him, that's a great place to start. But there's ever so much more in the book. But I heard somewhere along the way that has fostered an interest in tourism in the area. And sure, that's fine, but it's not like you can go in and watch a hit being made. It's still just a very smallish, sleepy-ish kind of place. And coming from South Carolina, you know about small, sleepy towns, I'm sure.
Oh, I certainly do. And I have certain feelings of my own about that existence and growing up in that area. And, you know, South Carolina is, in spite of the things that come out of it now, it is not...
It's not hell on earth.
It is not hell on earth. There are genuinely good people there who have genuinely good intentions, and they are not all so disaffected and discollected. That's something that's unfortunately a recent type of thing. And
well, it's something that has been fostered along the way, I think. It is.
Yeah.
It's not accidental, Jim.
I mean, you know, Bob, these are not treasonous people by nature and by heart, because we have just as many veterans and people who have served this country as West Virginia that have come out of South Carolina. We really do.
Oh, sure. I mean, like every state in the Union, that state has given its fair share. I mean, good God. Alabama's done the same to the Second World War, to the Korean conflict. I mean, there was Rick Hall getting...
Well, you know, we South Carolinians are very much like the Chinese. We worship our ancestors, okay? And that's just something that's been brought up in us. That's all there is to it. Regardless of what they did during the great...
The recent
problem.
Unpleasantness.
Uh-huh, exactly. And it is... I think that spirit is more engendered out of respect and dignity for people who, did what they thought at that time was right, but it really wasn't right. But nonetheless, out of respect for your ancestors, I mean, you respect yours, I respect mine. And I know I, for one, have been able to rise above a lot of the stuff that's coming out now. And I, you know, what I hate to see is that spirit of of genuineness being so misconstrued and misused by a lot of people. And also misunderstood.
Well, there are good, progressive, decent people all over the country, and there are even some. The old line Eisenhower Republicans are a different breed.
They're good conservative people.
But these
have their own thing, and you know their own thing that has been so transmogrified.
I agree. But the people who have either by dint of their own ignorance or by a willful desire to join in a certain parade, you know, like the lady that we played the other night who was screaming, he's a communist dictator who tried to nuke Charleston.
Oh, that's just absolutely crazy. I don't know what the hair or where she came from. I mean, what she did. Did she see that? You remember that documentary they had about Charleston? It was a pseudo documentary in which some type of nuclear device exploded
Charleston. I do, but that's not what that was, Jim.
Sir?
That's not what that was.
I know, but
what
that's where I think this woman probably.
No, it isn't. No, it isn't. In fact, Sparky did some research, and I did some research. Out there in the wild, bug-eyed fringes of the right wing, they really believe that a few months back, that Barack Obama ordered his generals to set off a nuclear device in Charleston. They refused. He fired them, and it actually went off out at sea. It's not being taken from like the sum of all fears, you know, where the suitcase goes off in Baltimore or anything like that. They really, really, all the way down to their little toenails, believe this.
Where did this come from?
I don't have the link immediately to hand, but I read it. Sparky provided it to me. There are really seedy, creepy places in the right wing side of the internet where they just post. I mean, it's the same mindset that says that he only released the short form of his birth certificate. I want to see the long form where it says Kenya was his birthplace. It's born of a deep, I mean, this is not political disagreement, Jim.
No, but something like this woman heard, wherever she got it, and you've researched it. I mean, that needs to be, whoever provided that, those people need to be brought to justice.
But it's not criminal. It's not criminal.
They need to be put in jail.
But it's not criminal conduct.
It is criminal to me. It's just as criminal as anything that Joseph Goebbels would have put out in the 30s or Father Conklin would have put out in the 30s as well.
And see, they didn't run Father Coughlin off to the Hoosegow either. This is the ugly, hateful side of the American id. I
want to ask you something. What is the difference between putting something like that out and inciting a riot?
Well, that's a question we've been asking for a very long time, because I've asked the question when Bill O'Reilly hollers Tiller the Killer night after night after night, and somebody finally goes and murders Dr. Tiller in church. How was Bill O'Reilly not at least partially the trigger man?
You know, he's got to be one of the most disgusting.
Well, he absolutely is, Jim.
People I've ever heard, and why Don Imus has him on, I don't know. Because Imus is pretty astute at realizing, you know, truth from fiction.
But in the case of, you know, why isn't he in jail? It's because the First Amendment has very long skirts behind which one can hide, and so. Where if Bill O'Reilly was standing next to the shooter yelling Tiller the Killer and the guy then murdered Dr. Tiller, you would say there would be no doubt whatsoever that Bill O'Reilly was an accessory before the fact, which in most jurisdictions is charged the same as the crime itself. But because we perceive some sort of an unbridgeable gulf between an electronic communicator and the people to whom he communicates and the people whom he incites to do these things, he becomes untouchable. I referenced last night on the program, you may recall, Adkisson, James or Jim Adkisson, East Tennessee. He shot up the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Knoxville on an evening when they were putting on a children's version of Annie. And he left a manifesto and a library saying, I am doing this because I can't kill Nancy Pelosi, and I can't kill, but they were straight off of a list that had been produced by Bernard Goldberg in his book of traitors or treason or whatever. And he said, since I can't kill the heads of the liberals, I'll just kill the regular liberals. And he admitted it. And it's all there. You can go read it online. And he got all those ideas from Michael Savage, from Sean Hannity, from Bill O'Reilly, from Rush Limbaugh, from Bernie Goldberg, and they go untouched. Glenn Beck screams about the Tides Foundation until some individual gets liquored up and heads up the highway to go to San Francisco and shoot up the Tides Foundation, and mercifully got himself so drunk that he got pulled over on the way, and another appointment with the collector of the Second Amendment butcher's bill was averted.
Well, you know, this amendment that protects freedom of speech to do these things, it's like technology. It crowns and crucifies. So what are we going to do with it?
Well,
what kind of filter can we put on it? We can't, unfortunately.
Well,
if they can block these people, unfortunately, they can block other more reasonable people as well. I mean, who's going to be the arbiter? Who's going to be the decider?
In ancient times, and by ancient, I mean, you know, 50 years ago, that arbiter was a jury tried and true. And I think that's still the case, but the way that you'd have to have a prosecutor who was willing to put her career on the line in order to attempt it.
Well, I guess a prosecutor in certain levels would be elected. In certain cases, he'd be appointed, but he'd be have to be responsible to somebody.
Well, absolutely. But, I mean, even if it was a, and I can't imagine a federal statute being out there that would support. How is this, you know, how is this not, I don't know, incitement to terrorism? We've got all kinds of funky new laws about what constitutes terrorism. I don't know. Do you take the Beckley paper, Jim?
No.
Well, there was a story in yesterday's paper, and I just read it in horror. I mean, horror. There was a man who was wanted in Pennsylvania, and he had fled on outstanding charges of making terroristic threats. He had been detained on the West Virginia Turnpike when he took off again and was going, northbound in the southbound lane.
Oh, I saw him on the news. As a matter of fact, he was on the news and he was in a type of hospital gown. And they had that all over the news. I mean,
because he fled the police, and he wound up plowing head on into a vehicle, and he killed the driver, Mama.
Right.
He killed Mama, and he sent three teenage girls in critical condition to Charleston Area Medical Center, and I don't know what their status is now, but. Okay, because of the way, and this is sort of a little segue, Jim, from terror. You know, we live in a country that charges first graders now with making terroristic threats. Okay, those stories are out there. There's more than one of them.
I understand that, Bob.
And so here's this guy, who we don't even know what the terroristic threats that he made were, but. Here's this guy who flees Pennsylvania, flees these charges of making terroristic threats, and winds up killing a person and maybe crippling three others in Beckley. And that crime, that's a crime that did not even exist 14 years ago.
Oh no. You know, I want to say this in reference to Titanic Tuesday. To tell you the truth, I really miss the old fool that used to be on there compared to whom they have replaced him with.
Well, didn't they replace him with Andrea Tarantula's radio show?
You got
show?
It. Yeah. I mean, at least with him on the air, it was something to laugh at or something to say, oh, well, but this
Or at
woman,
least it was local.
Yeah, local.
I and mean, you might get Boss Man Wayne calling in from time to time.
Indeed.
Or a certain individual who shall remain nameless who might call in and flush his toilet on the air.
I'm sorry. I don't know what you're talking
about. I know
about.
You don't. You can't even conceive such conduct, can you, Jim?
Oh, no, not at all. Well, I mean, that's when he would really get on there and start ranting. And I used to call him up before he cut me off, and I said, you know, do you have a signal manometer or a blood pressure? You know what the hell that was. I said, a blood pressure cuff. And I said, you want to take it? I said, is this worth it for you to get on there and do all this stuff? But I mean, it used to be a little bit of fun and whatever. And then, of course, he was replaced with that horrible woman who is just...
Andrea Tarantula, yes.
Yeah, too much, too much, too much, too much, too much, too much. But nonetheless, times have certainly changed in the past 15 or 16 or just 10 years. I don't know where they're going. I will say this. Your last caller, I must admit, has an extremely pleasant voice to listen to. A very intelligent person. I'm not sure what her background is because I don't listen that often, but tonight's interview with your gentleman in Alabama and also with your last caller were very insightful.
Well, I enjoy those kind of conversations, and that's why, you know, that's
why we make
this be what it is.
And I can enjoy with Kate sometimes. It's good to depart from the traditional format on a Wednesday or whatever. And this is certainly one of those evenings. And so there it is, and there you have it. And
well,
I wish you all the best, and hope that you can have more people like that.
Well, it just depends on them making themselves available or me finding.
Well, it's very hard to cotton pick today, as far as that sort of thing is concerned.
Well, there's machinery now, but not always.
Understood. Well, listen, I know there are people who want to talk to you, but I enjoyed listening to this man and his story of basically coming up from nothing into a position of social and cultural and intellectual prominence.
Well, it's a fascinating tale, and the history he created is it's still touching people today.
Okay, well, listen, have a good evening.
All right, you too, Jim. Take care.
Bye.
Our buddy Jim calling from not too terribly far away from here. And both lines open in this this evening of desperate attempts to stay out of the toxic little swamp where we often, so often, find ourselves living. 304-574-8178. That's the Herald line. The Maud line is 304-663-HORN. Does that make better sense, Herald and Maud? I mean, Marty put it out there, so we can just think of it in those terms. What else? Well, it wouldn't be fair. One more interlude. Because everybody knows this. Listen to that organ.
On his bed.
Percy Sledge, who learned his singing chops. I think he worked in a hospital and would sing to his patients when he met Rick Hall. It is about 13 minutes before the hour, and just another gentle reminder, we try to raise $150 per evening. We're out a little bit in front, not a whole lot, out a little bit in front, thanks to a whole lot of help this month. A whole lot of help. And it would be nice to stay that way. So anybody who wants to help keep us out in front, well, we certainly do welcome the help. The PayPal interface is at headonradionetwork.com under the tab Contribute. Mailing address for folks wanting to work postally, The Horn. Checks and money orders made payable to The Horn. 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMV 318, Beckley, Beckley, WV 25801. I was fascinated by what Rick Hall said about the music business as it presently exists. A lot of that old recording industry structure is long gone. And, you know, it applies to radio, too. There are not that many stations that carry progressive anything. Progressive talk, progressive comedy. No, there aren't. And just not to say by any stretch of the imagination that I'm a musician, because I am not. Can't carry a tune in a bucket. See? But it's the same new normal for radio. You know, Larry King, not that I'm comparing, Larry King walked away from CNN, retired, and found himself, I couldn't stand it. So lo and behold, he created a new gig for himself. Is it internet-based? I can't recall. But it's the same kind of reality. And I don't know. I'm getting really inspired in here, just to let you guys know, let y'all know. Agnes has been a whirlwind back here. And probably, well, we have to travel this weekend. Oh, okay. Larry King is politicking on RT. Oh. That would hey, it's a gig, right? Oh, by the way, Bill, if you're still listening, no, the desktop app does not have the reading function. So, but the Kindle, what's it called? The Kindle Paperwhite is like $99, and it does. But what I was saying earlier, it may take. This is a rare. When you've had things sitting one particular way for about 10 years, rearranging everything doesn't come easy. But we finally got it. We've sat down and with a pencil and sketched out what it could look like, and it's actually possible that we could make some pretty bold strides into the future, in the fairly near future. Hopefully within maybe another month's time. Like I said, we have to travel this weekend. But it's really coming together nicely. Like I said, I've got the streaming software. I've got the streaming software for a Mac now, so it can handle the stream if it absolutely has to. And I don't know. I'm pretty excited about it. What do we do with the next 9 minutes? Tap dance? I could talk about my deep and abiding hopes for the Mountaineers. If our buddies in Kentucky hear this, between now and airtime tomorrow night, you're probably turning up. Oh, no, we can turn it. Yeah, we can turn off the podcast now. Bob's rooting for the Mountaineers. Kentucky basketball fans here. They're a right. They can be a right cranky lot. Of course, I'm sure they expect to waltz right across the court and probably walk all over us. But you know, maybe not. But lucky for us, that doesn't come on until 9:45 Eastern time tomorrow evening, so there will be no interference with the broadcast. Unless, of course, I'm just sort of a gelatinous nervous wreck, which you all will forgive. And we'll be back in the swamp tomorrow night. This is one of those evenings. We don't have a lot of them. I can't remember the last one, as a matter of fact. But don't worry, we'll be back to coffee breaks over, back on your heads, and screaming and cussing and carrying on. And God knows there's plenty to do that about. Thank heaven we dealt with Duck Doofus last night instead of tonight. But yeah, there's an overabundance of weird in this country. Hey, thank you, Asa. Thank you for helping out and being the first one to do so this evening. Much appreciated. We're now only $130 away from our evening's fundraising goal. Note coming in from Kevin in Colorado Springs. Kevin says, you said that freedom of speech has long skirts. You mean the kind of long skirts that had Georgia women arrested for protesting a bill that would allow employers to fire women who've had an abortion? Those kind of long skirts? I-O-K-I-Y-A-R. I guess. Yeah. Yeah, those kind of long skirts. Skirts you can hide behind. Right. Oh, wow. Thank you, Robert. Robert has, we are now only $105 away from fundraising for the evening. Thank you very, very much, Robert. Much appreciated. Oh, 6 minutes. And, you know, that's the thing. You can do 6 minutes of just awful. But this evening was such a thrill and such an uplifting thing. I can't bear to go there. No, my head is dancing with visions of awesome barbecue and amazing hot dogs that can be found only in one little place in Northwest Alabama, and music, and thinking back on my misspent youth. No, it was well spent. Who am I kidding? But the funniest thing of all was that by the time I turned 18 years old, the only thing I wanted to see was the shoals in my rearview mirror. And that, well, it's the nature of youth. Helen Keller left, too. W.C. Handy didn't write the Tuscumbia Blues. He wrote the Memphis Blues and the St. Louis Blues. Mm-hmm. He left. But after a while, you begin to think that maybe there was something special there. I don't know. Maybe this summer the opportunity presents itself. I'll get in that cushy ride and toddle down to the Tennessee Valley. 11 miles from the Tennessee state line, 30 miles from Mississippi. Just see what's shaking down that way. So, yeah, it's time to get out of here. Thank you. Thank you to Robert and to Asa for helping out this evening. Thank you to everybody who helps out, well, shucks, for the last 10 years, every evening, to keep all of this going. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky, in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan and Carol Baker. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. I hope you got to hear some of this. I think you might enjoy it. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thank you to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACHEACT, ACHEACT.org. And always, 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 Gina. It's all for you. Hey, we'll get right back to it tomorrow, I promise. Because it's going to be Thorn in the Side Thursday, right?